history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this incredible country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some seemingly ordinary men and women around you who have done really extraordinary things for the sake of our country. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a whole lot. We're educated, we're always entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I am in Hollister, California, sitting with Mr. Del Byler, who they said was 98 years old, but I don't know if I'm buying it. Is that true? 98 years old?
And a half.
Okay, see, it wasn't true. 98 and a half. And this is going to be some kind of journey we're going to hear today. It spans World War II and the Korean War, and even some history that a lot of people don't know in Vietnam. But I want to go back to Kansas. You're born in Garden City, Kansas, but you grow up pretty much in the middle of nowhere, it sounds like.
Calvista, Kansas. Calvista was our mailbox city. Our dad had a ranch, and I worked on the ranch. Calvista was a town of 12 people. We lived 7 miles from downtown, so we were pretty much out in the middle of nowhere.
I didn't know that a town of 12 people could have a downtown. What's the difference between downtown and uptown?
Well, we had 2 gas stations, a general store, and a couple of residences, that's all.
And later on, when you became a father, I'm sure you regaled your children with stories about what you had to do to get to school in the morning.
Oh, I did. Actually, people they think I was kidding when I said it was 7 miles to school.
7 miles from your house to the school?
But after I was married, we went there and I had a new Buick and I timed it and it was 7 miles if you go by the roads.
But you didn't go by the roads?
No, I wouldn't go by. I'd cut across the prairie or across the alfalfa fields, but mainly across the prairie.
And what was your mode of transportation?
Horseback or walking. In the winter, you don't want to go horseback because it's too darn cold. You get frozen sitting on top of a horse in the winter. So I walked or rode a horse 7 miles. I went to a one-room schoolhouse. We had usually 5 or 6 students in the whole school. It was one room. And I went through the 9th grade there. Then I had to go to high school, and I went to Topeka, Kansas. And my aunt and uncle took me in for the school years.
Well, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who are a little envious. They wish they had gotten to ride a horse to school. But how young were you when you were riding a horse to school?
Oh, I was riding a horse when I was still on the Dills Ranch, 4 or 5. I was too young. I would get the horse, lead him up to the gate there where you could kind of climb up on the boards. It was Alabama. I still remember that horse's name. He was a very gentle horse. We'd lead him up to the gate, and I'd climb up the gate boards and get a straddle of him. I wouldn't do anything rash, but I could ride my horse.
Well, I mean, I'm just thinking about your parents. You send a kid off alone on horseback 7 miles away, expecting him to actually make it back with the same horse? That the horse doesn't run off somewhere while he's in school?
Well, we had a big barn. The barn was larger than the school, actually. Yeah.
So you weren't the only one riding your horse to school?
No. No, there are 2 or 3 of us who rode horses to school. But I think I had the farthest distance to school. And the school teacher always stayed with us. Every year, school teacher stayed with us. We had the nicest house.
Well, I bet you got good grades, too, if you had the school teacher staying in your house.
No, that didn't affect it. But it was camaraderie anyway.
Uh-huh. That's a colorful childhood. Do you remember in those days having some ambitions, having some dreams that someday you wanted to do this and that?
Yes. Even when I was a little guy riding a horse or driving a tractor, I always thought that I wanted to do, when I retired, which I didn't know when it would be, I had no idea to be here, that I wanted to be self-sufficient. I didn't want to depend on the children. So I planned a long, long time ago to make enough money so I could retire. And I did.
When did this idea of flying airplanes first cross your mind?
When I was in Chicago, actually, during the terrible dust storms we had in western Kansas, you may have read about them. Those were terrible. People died in those darn things. That was very tough on Dad. I remember we drove cattle all the way from Cal Vista to Dodge City, which is over quite a distance. I dropped out of college. I went to Chicago. I still had a work, ethic. And the owner of Permaflex liked me because I pitched in. And anyway, make a long story short, he had an airplane. He paid for my first lessons and paid for my instruction and all and my flying expenses. And I had my private license, and I was going to like to fly. I was determined to fly.
What was the first airplane you flew?
Probably an Aronca.
Aronca, yeah.
I think.
You mentioned dropping out of college, so you're actually at the University of Kansas in Lawrence, and you hear what's going on with your dad, and you thought you needed to make some money?
Yes, I didn't want to take any more money from Dad for college.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried, I was a pre-med at that time. I was trying to work and pay my expenses, and I didn't like it very well. So I dropped out of college and went to Chicago and worked there for a while, and that's where I learned to fly.
Mm-hmm. And that's where you were on December 7th, 1941, huh?
Exactly. Yes, what sir. It was devastating to me. I had a good friend that worked at Permaflex where I worked. He and I together went, I don't know, 7 or 7:30, December 8th, to downtown Chicago to enlist in the aviation program. That was the Air Corps at that time, and that was the morning after Pearl Harbor, and we were downtown at least by 8 o'clock at the time the place
opened. Why was that so important to you? Why were you in such a hurry?
Well, I've always felt kind of patriotic. I had a couple of years of college, and I was in good physical shape. I didn't know it, but I was colorblind. I found out that I was colorblind. I missed some of the color charts, mm-hmm. and the examiners said, oh, well, he's in good physical shape, and he's qualified for everything else. I was actually sworn into the Army Air Corps. Then I quit my job and went home to the ranch. I didn't get any, I was supposed to get orders. I didn't get any orders for a while, so I wrote to the Air Corps and said, here I am, maybe you forgot. I wish I'd kept that letter. That was a classic letter I got, personally signed by the head of the Air Corps, thanking me for my patriotism, but I was colorblind. Report to your draft board. That was a disaster. I didn't want to report the draft board. I wanted to fly. Mm-hmm. I had to report the draft board to register, but I didn't want to do it.
So you found another way.
Yes, it was kind of laborious. I heard that carrots were good for your eyes, so I ate a lot of carrots. I learned to read the color charts.
You cheated.
I did cheat. I cheated, but I made it. I was successful.
Not that we want to prescribe this for anyone else who might have these ideas, but how'd you cheat? How'd you pull that off? How'd you beat the test?
Well, I learned that, first of all, I tried to build up my eyes. I don't know how much good that did. I really don't. But I learned that by squinting and kind of following the characters there, I could read them. I gave myself one day to enlist. I told them that I had flunked out of the Army aviation program because I was colorblind. But hell, I could read the charts. So they said, you're in.
So you proved it to them.
And then I was 5 pounds underweight.
So you're still not home free. So you find a way to cheat the test, but they still won't take you because you're too skinny.
Yeah, another disaster. I was 5 pounds underweight. I had been living pretty well at that point. I was making lots of money, and I was living too well. But anyway, I was under their minimums. So I went out in Chicago to a restaurant and ate a huge breakfast, and I'd heard the bananas were good, were weighty, so I ate all the bananas I could think of, and I took a big drink of water before I got on the scale, and I gained 5.5 pounds in an hour.
Wow.
And they said, fine, sign here.
So you're in. You finally have your goal of being in an aviation program, but getting from there to fighter pilot is a long journey. Were there some other hurdles you had to clear?
Well, there were hurdles. I was in the first class to go all the way through from flight prep at Liberty, Missouri. And then I graduated eventually from Corpus Christi. I was serious about my flying. I enjoyed it. And I was doing okay on the flying part.
What did it feel like for you to be in the cockpit? What was the thrill that you got out of it?
Well, that's a good question. Nobody has ever asked me that before, but there's a feeling of, I'm kind of a bug about control. I had control of independence, and I loved to fly. It just was a great pleasure.
But isn't it a little nuts to fly off a carrier and then have to land on it, especially at night?
Well, I had to build up to that a little bit. I graduated from Corpus Christi, got my wings at Corpus Christi. Then I went to Melbourne, Florida. The powers that be said, we need night fighters. Who will volunteer to be a night fighter? Hell, we didn't want to volunteer. We're going to fight the war. I think only one guy volunteered for night fighting. That wasn't enough. They took the top percent of the class and said, you're now night fighters. So I became a night fighter.
So when you say we didn't want to be night fighters, we wanted to go fight the war, you mean you knew that night fighters meant you'd have to go through more training.
Oh, yes, exactly.
And you wanted to go over there right now and
I
fight
was
the
ready.
Japanese.
Yeah. I was a hot pilot, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I wasn't, but I thought so.
And at the time you're flying Hellcats, F-6Fs?
F-6F. Uh-huh. Then I started flying the F-6F-5N. That's the night fighter version of the Hellcat.
So how did you feel about that? I mean, here you're saying you're hot to go overseas and get some action, but they're keeping you
well,
here to learn night fighting.
Paul, I'm not sure what service you've had, but when you're in the service, the thing to do, you do it because you're there. What the hell? I mean, that's the only reason you do.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no excuse.
So don't waste your time worrying about it, huh?
No time to worry about it.
All right. Well, how big of a challenge was that to learn how to do all of this in the dark?
It was a big challenge. Flying nights. Well, we went to Vero Beach and flew for a while after Melbourne. We had the top equipment of any of the Navy. Actually, I shouldn't tell you this, but we used to flat out over the Everglades, and we had friends at the Everglades Club, and we would sometimes come over Lake Worth at minimum altitude, because we had the equipment for it, and buzz Lake Worth, and a few things like this. That's a few things I shouldn't have done.
Buzzed a few people down there? Buzzed a few crocodiles? Alligators?
Everything down there, Paul.
Uh-huh. Well, and explain to folks who might not understand, what's the difference there? What was so special about these new altimeters you had?
Well, they were accurate. They let you fly. Actually, I flew under telephone wires one time there. See what I could.
That's pretty low.
It's just the best equipment, is all, Paul.
And it used a radio frequency to give you an accurate
yes.
altitude reading?
It was actually radio waves that bounce off the land or the water.
Mm-hmm.
And we trained it over the ocean a lot. If depending on whether it's the sky was dark or whether it was light, if it was dark, we would try to approach the bogey above them, maybe 150 feet or something. And if the sky was light, we'd try to silhouette the bogey above the sky.
Hmm.
And we'd fly pretty low. I wouldn't recommend it for everybody, but it was kind of fun.
Well, the implication is that the margin for error is a lot smaller, right? I mean, when you're flying in those conditions, when you're flying at that low altitude and
yeah.
in the dark.
Well, there are other margins of errors that are smaller later on, but yes, that's true.
Well, you're teasing us, huh? You're letting us know that we have something to look forward to that's even more hair-raising. Have you ever thought about what would have happened to you if they didn't divert you to the night fighting squadron? If you had been able to go overseas right then?
Yeah, I would have gone overseas and probably been. My training was carrier-based.
Mm-hmm.
I flew all my flying was off of straight deck carriers. And do you know the difference between a straight deck and a canted deck carrier?
Mm-hmm.
Straight deck carriers are fine for props, but they're too darn small for jets.
Right.
But my squadron in Korea was all of us were flying jets off of straight deck carriers. That was the Essex, the old Essex. I would have been aboard the carriers.
Well, I just bring it up because I'm sure you're confident. I'm sure you believe you would have made it through there, but there are a lot of fighter pilots who got shot down over there.
Yeah, well, I am fortunate. I came through whole.
His six children are certainly thankful for that. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come from 98-year-old Del Beiler of Hollister, California. a Navy fighter pilot who flew both propeller-driven and jet aircraft off of carriers, even at night, and even in very sensitive times when America was not supposed to be involved. We're going to hear about that before we're done. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of Dell, then and now. And we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 98-year-old Dell Byler of Hollister, California, originally from rural western Kansas, where once upon a time he used to ride his horse 7 miles to his one-room schoolhouse. During World War II, he was operating a little more horsepower as a Navy fighter pilot. He had trained in F-6F Hellcats and was about to head overseas in August of 1944 when the top 10% of his class was siphoned off for night fighter training, learning to take off and land on carriers in the dark. Before he eventually headed overseas, he got married. But I got to get that whole story, Dell. How'd you first meet your wife, Jeannie?
I met her in Chicago at a dinner party. Flo and John Young. Flo was a dad of ours. Jeannie was there, and I was there. She was a very attractive young woman, but she was so young. I thought, oh, she's a pretty young girl, but she's too young for me. And she wasn't too sure. Anyway, we went together for 4 years, and we got married, and we were married for over 60 years, and she's been passed away for 12 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And we had 6 children. We had a wonderful marriage. I was very fortunate in my flying and very fortunate in my marriage.
Well, I'm just curious. I mean, you guys decided to get married right before you were going to go overseas, and you don't know how long the war's going to last.
We were married when I was at Martha's Vineyard, the final stages of night flying in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
ready to go overseas. And we decided to get married then. And Dick LeBar, my best man, and I flew in military planes to Grosse Ile. I had 5 days leave to get married. So Dick and I went to a hotel, and we practiced the day before the marriage, because we arrived the day before the marriage. That's a terrible, one of the worst things ever happened to me. The day of our marriage, we were at the hotel. It was a big hotel, it covered a square block in Detroit. Dick lived near Detroit. He had a car and a steady girlfriend. So he went to see his girlfriend, and he came back, and I said, your uniform needs pressing, Dick. He said, I'll get it pressed while you go check out. So I went to check out, but the hotel has 4 entrances. I went to one entrance, Dick went to the other. We missed each other. Finally, I took a taxi to the wedding. I was 12 minutes late for my own wedding.
and she still married you, huh?
Yeah, Dick LeBar. Anyway, to kind of culminate that, Dick got killed not too soon after that. Coming aboard a carrier. I was not on that carrier at that time. But Dick landed aboard the carrier, made a successful landing. But these are straight deck carriers, much more dangerous than canted decks. Straight deck carriers, you land, you only have half the ship to use. Amidships is the big fence. They dropped the big fence. Dick taxied up here, ready to go down, take the elevator down. And the guy behind him, the pilot behind him, landed aboard with hung ordnance. You're not supposed to have hung ordnance. It's too dangerous for landing. And as he landed, the ordnance came loose, skittered across the deck, and killed Dick. Mm. It wasn't his fault. He was just getting out of his plane.
Yeah, that had to be devastating news for you.
Well, anyway, those things happen. It's not the safest vocation in the world.
And now you're ready to head overseas yourself. The war's still going on in the Pacific, but you're going to have to say goodbye to your new bride and, as far as you know, go risk your life, right?
Well, that was a separate and I think, kind of an interesting part of my life. I went overseas. I was stationed at Barbers Point and was flying to the carriers. We were supposed to go aboard the Enterprise for the invasion of Japan, and that was the biggest armada I had ever seen. We had collected ships and pilots and planes from different islands and different places in the Pacific. That armada stretched from horizon to horizon. You wouldn't believe it. And we were in the center because I was aboard the Enterprise. Mm-hmm. That was Admiral Sherman's flagship. And you look in any direction and nothing but warships. Mm. We were going in. I don't think any human could have stopped us. Mm. We would have lost a lot of men, and the Japanese would have lost a lot of men. Okay. But about halfway over, they dropped the atomic bombs and said, the war's over, go home. And that was fine, and I was on the right ship at the right time. So they turned the Enterprise around with escort carriers, a couple of cruisers, and several destroyers, and shot us through the canal for Navy Day. And that's a separate story.
Well, you can tell that story, but I am interested what the celebration was like when you heard that Japan had surrendered. Was there a big celebration on the Big E?
Not so. Everybody was happy. We were all happy because the war was over. Mm-hmm. And we're going home. And there wasn't any outright celebration, for sure. We didn't break out the rum or anything. But it's kind of interesting on the way to New York for Navy Day. Off Atlantic City, the captain of the Enterprise said, any of you fighter pilots that want to fly into New York a day early, raise your hand. Send me in, coach.
You didn't hesitate, huh?
No. So we went in a day early and landed. And Jeannie, my wife, my bride, didn't know that I was coming a day early. So her dad, Manly Chestnut, he lived at this hotel. He gave us his room at the hotel and went someplace else. So we had a good place to stay.
Well, where'd you surprise her? She didn't know you were coming into New York City, huh?
No, she didn't know I was coming. That was one of the best events I ever had. Her dad and I, she was getting in Grand Central Station. She was coming off the train. Her dad went up to greet her, and I kind of hid halfway behind a post or something. She threw her arms around her dad, of course. Maybe shouldn't have done it. I came up beside her and said, carry your bags, lady. And she flipped. She recognized my voice. We had a great time in New York. We were footloose, fancy free, and had everything at our disposal.
Sounds like a scene from a movie or something, doesn't it? Grand Central Station?
Yeah.
Surprise greeting? And the war's over?
That's right, it was.
Were you ever at all disappointed that you didn't personally get to go over there and fly combat missions with all the time that you put in training and all the investment you had?
I didn't have a chance to shoot down any enemy planes. I did a lot of flying, and when I was ready, I never had a chance to really put my training to use. Mm-hmm. But I did a lot of training and a lot of flying.
So World War II's over. You're released from active duty. Did you think you'd ever be flying military planes again?
Well, not at that point, Paul. Not right away. But I was married. We were starting our family. Mm-hmm. I had two wonderful children, Diane and Jan, and I didn't have any money, and I liked to fly, so I joined the Ready Reserve again. I'd fly some Hellcats, but I was flying FH-1s, which was a predecessor to the FH-2, and F-8F. F-8 was an interesting plane. I made a dead stick landing once in an F-8F, but
well, you can't just say that. You got to tell me the story. What happened?
I'll get around to it. Let me finish this a little bit.
Okay.
If I may. I started because I needed the money. And I like to fly, so I was in the Ready Reserve and flying F-8s, FH-1s, F-2H-3s, Banshees and stuff, and it was good. All of a sudden, the career came along, and they ordered our whole squadron to report. Anybody under a certain age and with not three children, but I had two, report for active duty, which I did. So I was in Korea. This thing at the barrel.
Oh, so are you saying if you had had a third child, you wouldn't have had to go?
That's right.
You slacker. Could have gotten yourself off the hook.
Who knows? But this, the F-8 is kind of interesting because I did make a dead stick landing in F-8. It was trying out the plane at Glenview. It just been through maintenance, and I was by myself, just flying by myself. I was flying over the North Shore, which is populated, as you know.
Yeah, you're talking about Chicago for folks who didn't pick up on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
North Shore Chicago is very populated.
Uh-huh.
But I was west of Chicago a little bit. All of a sudden, a major oil line broke in this darn thing. And I had oil all over my windshield. And I knew enough, it was a heavy flow of oil. I knew enough that this plane ain't going to land, fly very long without oil. So I just got all the altitude I could, headed back toward Glenview, and told them I was going to make an emergency landing if I could. So it did quit. But I had enough altitude and I was close enough to feel that I made it without an engine.
Were you gritting your teeth a little bit on that landing? Were you nervous that you wouldn't quite make the runway?
I wasn't really nervous. It's either you make it or you die, one of the two. Which is it? So I never thought about being nervous then. I'm sure I was.
Mm-hmm.
But I made it. And I came in high and hot, landed the plane on one of the runways at Glenview, burned up the brakes on the runway. At the end of the runway, I started to a little more speed than I wanted, so I ground looped it. Never scratched paint on the plane, but I burned up the brakes.
Sounds like a good pilot. Sounds like some skill at work there. I'm sure this all went by very quickly, but you mentioned how populated the area you're flying over is. I mean, there had to be a moment where you're concerned that it might not just be you that dies.
You don't blame it. And if you have any conscience, you don't bail out of a plane and let it fall where it's going to fall. It could fall on a church. It could fall on a school. It's going to probably kill somebody.
But technically, that was an option for you. You could have bailed out and saved yourself, knowing that others would have died.
It would have been safer. It would have been safer, if that's your question, yeah.
So you risked your own life to make sure you didn't claim any others.
Well, the best option was to get that plane back to Glenview.
And you made it.
I made it without an engine. Mm-hmm. Part of the way. At the very end, I had no engine.
Mm-hmm. So what's the no radio story?
That's after the Korean War. We came back to Glenview, and we were a Banshee squadron, F-283 squadron at that point, and it was all the time in Korea.
And a lot of people might not be familiar with that plane. It's not one of the more well-known planes. What can you tell us about the Banshee?
The Banshee is a twin-engine plane made by McDonnell. It's a twin-engine, and it's a heavy plane. Another guy and I flew to Detroit. And coming back, we landed to refuel to make it all the way to the Moffett Field. Afternoon, they were to take off for Moffett. He downed his plane, and I was anxious to get back. So I took off anyway and was flying solo at night over Salt Lake City. My radio went out. My electrical system went out. I didn't have lights. I didn't have a radio. And I was headed back to Moffett. So the only thing to do is just continue. And if this were the tower, I couldn't radio in that I was in trouble to give me a clear landing strip. So I buzzed the tower. You fly by at the tower level as fast as you can at night. It gets the attention of the people there.
I would say so.
I made a landing okay. Then the summation of that flight was kind of scary because going into the radio room, which was one of the hangars at Moffett Field, my suit, my anti-G suit, felt kind of squishy. It didn't feel normal. And I checked, and the darn thing was full of gas. Glenview, the maintenance people had made a mistake. You have hydraulic pressure to your gas tanks and the wings and things, and also hydraulic pressure for your anti-gravity suit. And somebody installed something wrong in there. My suit that I was wearing was full of air and gas and aviation gas. It kind of scared me. I guess I wasn't around any sparks to set it off, but still it wasn't a very good thing to have happen.
Good thing you didn't light a match.
No, I would have gone up in a big flame.
Well, and you know, we talked about World War II, and you spent most of the war training and were overseas on your way to hit Japan when the war ended. I'm sure people hear you mentioning the Korean War, and they're wondering what kinds of things you were doing in those planes during the Korean War.
I flew over, again, they never came up to meet us over Korea. I flew over Korea. I spent time on the deck there as a guest of the Air Force, but I was fortunate in a way in that I hit the hot spot right after the armistice. After the armistice in Korea, we never dropped any bombs in anger, but we were flying over Korea. I was on the Essex at that time, straight deck carrier Essex. And they sent us to the Asian theater, cruising right off the coast of Vietnam. And we were between, we'd go to the Philippines and back to Vietnam. That was kind of, I had some interesting flights that way, but the most interesting part of that was the French were under siege at Dien Bien Phu while we were there. We were, as far as we're concerned, we went on war footing to help the French. They held up our mail home for 3 weeks. Our wives didn't know why, but there's no mail for 3 weeks. And we were flying over Dien Bien Phu off the carrier. This photograph is just before a cap hop that we flew. But you can see in this photo we were wearing sidearms. And the briefs that we had, we were briefed on escape and evasion. And in our planes, the main thing, in our fighter planes, in the Banshees, we had full ammunition fed in to the chamber. You normally have full, the ammunition aboard gives us the right weight on the plane, but you sure don't have it fed in. We had ammunition fed in. All we had to do was flip a switch and pull the trigger, and we were in business. We had 20-millimeter cannon on the planes at that time, which was pretty powerful firepower.
And there were elements within the U.S. military complex that wanted you guys to use that firepower. Who knows what that would have led to and how it might have changed history. We're going to dive a little deeper into that when we come back. More from Del Byler's Navy flying days, as well as a more recent mission with Honor Flight Bay Area. Don't forget to check out the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our fascinating visit today with 98-year-old Del Byler of Hollister, California, very close to Pinnacles National Park, where you can go watch the rare but majestic California condors in flight. A popular and historic stop on the road in and out of the national park is the Inn at Tres Pinos. And if you've ever enjoyed a meal there, you might have seen today's guest without even realizing it. One of the restaurant walls there features a photo from the aircraft carrier USS Essex in the Gulf of Tonkin in 1954. You'll see four fighter pilots, all with sidearms visible, about to take off in their F-2H-3 Banshee jet fighters and fly fully armed over Dien Bien Phu in Vietnam. If you know your history, you know Dien Bien Phu is where the communist Viet Minh scored a major victory over the French that would set the stage for the partitioning of Southeast Asia. Maybe you even know that two American civilian pilots working under the auspices of the CIA were killed while flying humanitarian airdrop missions over Dien Bien Phu in 1954. They're regarded as the first American casualties of the Vietnam War, a conflict that regular U.S. combat units wouldn't get involved in until a full decade later. But how differently would history have unfolded if America had decided to get involved earlier? There was actually a plan at the time called Operation Vulture that involved American B-29s flying in from the Philippines to bomb the Viet Minh, perhaps with even as many as three nuclear weapons. That never happened, but there were American planes with American pilots flying over the besieged city of Dien Bien Phu as the French tried desperately to hold on. And one of those pilots was Del Byler in his fully armed Banshee.
Dien Bien Phu fell while we were flying over it.
But if you look at the history books, it says, well, America let France use some of our planes and even an aircraft carrier, the Belleau Wood. But it doesn't say anything about Americans actually flying warplanes.
Paul, hardly anybody in America knows how close we were to coming to war or what we were doing. We were, as far as we're concerned, we're at war. We were wearing personal sidearms every time we fly. We had full ammunition fed into our airplanes. We were flying over the Edmonton, escorting the F-9s, which were the photo planes, and getting ready to do serious work over there.
Yeah.
Hardly anybody knows about that in the United States. But I was there. I can attest to it.
Yeah, this was a secret deal because America's trying to be politically smart. I mean, the Korean War has just come to an end. Nobody wants another war. But they also don't want communism to run unchecked.
And we want to help our allies, the French, I guess.
Yeah, and so you didn't know. You didn't know if they were going to give you the go-ahead to use some of your firepower.
We felt that 95% sure we were going to fight.
What
we were on a wartime basis.
Uh-huh. I mean, had enemy fighters approached you, would you have been firing?
Then approached, but we were ready for it. That's why we had the ammunition fed in.
If they did, you would have fired.
We would have shut them down, or at least fought them. Yes, absolutely.
But other than that, your orders were don't fire unless fired upon.
This was a CAP hop, a combat air patrol hop. This photo was taken my squadron just before we took off, and a combat air patrol. That's CAP to protect the fleet.
Right.
And we had orders then to shoot if we needed to shoot. That's how close we were to coming to war.
Yeah, what do you think would have happened?
I'm not going to estimate.
I'm sure you've thought about that over the years.
Oh, yeah. Well, it would have been a war. I don't know whether we could have won the war even if we fought it. We owned the skies, Paul, but I don't think we... I doubt if we would have won the war. I really doubt it. Hmm. It would have been more expensive. A lot of people, more people would have died, but we never won it. As it was, and I don't think we would have won it if we'd gone to war then.
So basically it would have just been starting the Vietnam War 10 years earlier than it started, from an American standpoint.
Yeah, that's right.
So a lot of your stories, from World War II to Korea to Vietnam, they have a common thread of what could have happened, what almost happened but didn't. I know you're thankful you survived it all, and I think you're pretty proud of what you and your fellow pilots did.
I'm proud of a couple of things, Paul. I'm proud of my family. I have a great family of 6 children, and it is a great family. And the second thing, I flew jets off of a carrier at night, and not many guys would dare do that. It's precision flying. As you're coming in the groove, getting ready to land on a carrier, it's no time to read the manual. That, again, I told you a while ago, you do things like this because you're there, and you're expected to do it, so what the hell, you do it.
When you look back at all the time you spent in those planes, is there one incident that you look back and say, you know, that was probably the closest call I had? That's the one that easily could have gone the other way?
I had a few close calls on the training at night at Martha's Vineyard and so forth, because you have a lot of planes coming together, and I had some planes just barely miss me in the air. Every flight is different. Every flight is kind of hairy. They're all sort of hairy if you get jets at night off the straight deck carrier. We bring the Banshee aboard at about 123 knots, depending on how much weight we had, which is about 140, 145 miles an hour. And you have half the deck to use. The carrier deck was some 905 feet long. The big fence is amidships. The first cable is so far after the ship. You don't have much space.
You don't have much margin for error, huh? You better be pretty perfect.
There's hardly practically no margin for error, Paul. And I'm not saying that just to shoot myself, but all of us did that. One of my good friends, Bill Lusick, landing is during the day on the Essex. He was coming aboard, and for some reason, his tail hook broke. It hit the deck. Instead of catching a wire, it broke. So we all knew that Bill Lusick was going to come in and hit the fence. So most of the pilots that weren't flying, including myself, went up on Vulture's Row, as we called it. With Vulture's Row, that's where you watch the carnage going on.
Oh, man.
And came on board. You have the big fence. It's about yay high. You have a cable, a huge cable, top and bottom. And then strong nylon risers. That's the big fence. They called it the barrier. We called it the big fence. That'll stop you. You can fly right into the thing, it'll stop you. But trouble with the Banshee, it has a sloped nose. And then if you have your cockpit open, if you hit the big fence, that top carrier under pressure is going to chop right down, and that'll spoil your day. So we had the option of landing with canopies open or canopies closed. You choose it. I did it both ways. Anyway, Bill Lusick landed aboard. He broke his jaw and a few other things.
Yeah, and I'm sure you were always aware of what could happen to you, how dangerous this work was because of what you saw happening to others.
Gordon Farber was the first casualty of our squadron. On the cross lake, coming aboard the carrier, went into the water. I saw him. I saw his plane go in. And the helicopter got there as soon as they could, but for some reason they couldn't get him, never got him out of there. We lost about 10% of our jet pilots during just aviation accidents during the Korean War.
Were you ever concerned that you were going to be one of those?
I didn't want to be. I wanted to be a good enough pilot, I would not be. So, yes, I would be concerned, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you can't help it. Things go wrong with your plane, or like Dick, my best man at my wedding, he landed aboard the carrier, was getting off his plane, and the guy behind him had a bomb, a hung bomb, and came up and killed him. It wasn't Dick's fault. So you can't really tell, Paul. I'm thankful that I came through unscathed. I wound up with 13 years of satisfactory service just from flying. And then I went to NRS school and in the weekend warrior bit. I have 21 years in.
You got to be a guinea pig, too. The USS Hancock.
Oh, yes.
They wanted to test out catapult that was using steam instead of hydraulics?
Yeah, the Banshee was a heavy plane.
Right.
It was a heavy fighter. Normal weight without armament, I think it's about 10 tons. We had the hydraulic catapults is all we used up to that point. The Navy decided to go to a step above that to go to steam catapults. They wanted to test them with heavy planes. So two of us at Moffett Field flew down to the Hancock, and we landed aboard her, and then we did each of us a half a dozen shots off the Hancock to test the heavy planes. By the way, those steam cats are marvelous. You can sell tickets on those things.
Well, I want to ask you about that, but I got to know first, did you volunteer for that?
Yes.
What's wrong with you? Why would you volunteer for something nobody else has ever done before?
That's just the way I am, Paul.
I mean, weren't you kind of a guinea pig there?
Yeah. Kind of a guinea pig.
Were you nervous at all?
I don't know about nervous, being apprehensive, maybe. You don't want to make mistakes, Paul. I didn't want to make a mistake. If you make a mistake, you can kill yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Easy. No problem.
And you said that those steam catapults are great. You could sell tickets. So I'm
steam
guessing
catapults are marvelous. That's all they use anymore.
And what does it feel? What did it feel like when they launched you off?
Oh, well, that's kind of interesting. On the old hydraulic cats, the procedure is you get off, you taxi up and they rev up your engines and check, and then you check your instruments, make sure they're working and everything, and you get the engines to full speed. Then you get a hold of the stick and you put your elbow in your gut. Over here is your throttle, and there's a little stop on the throttle you pull out from the bulkhead, and that keeps you from involuntarily pulling back on the throttle when your catapult is off. And the hydraulic cats are pretty severe. They give you a jolt. I mean, bang. And it's not much fun, and they give you a jolt. The worst thing that you ever concerned about is a cold shot. You don't want a cold shot off of a catapult because you go under the ship. And the steam cats are very different. You start out slow, and you build up gradually, and it's just a nice experience. A lot of fun. I like the steam cats.
I want to ask you a little bit about your most recent mission. You got to go with your daughter as your guardian to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Bay Area and see the National World War II Memorial and the Korean War Memorial. What was that trip like for you?
Oh, boy, that was like once in a lifetime. That was a great trip. That was marvelous. They crowded so much into 3 days doing that. We had police escort when we went from one base to the next with the police car in front with the sirens going and the red lights flashing. And then the one day we had motorcycles instead of that. But we had police escorts every place we went. We even went against traffic at times.
Makes you feel pretty important, doesn't it?
Oh, man, it makes you feel really important. The people on the outside wonder who those dignitaries are.
Oh, there's some really important people.
It was
people.
Great. It was a marvelous. I highly recommend that trip to everybody.
What did you think about when you were at that World War II Memorial?
Well, the World War II Memorial is the big one. That has the places of honor for each state. I was kind of in awe about the whole thing, to tell you the truth, Paul. That's the only time I'd seen that or seen any of those memorials. I was awed by the World War II Memorial, and I was pleased that we had such a wonderful memorial.
When you're at the World War II and you see all those gold stars up there, And it says this represents 406,000 Americans who died in World War II.
You know something? That was one of my biggest things I remember. We lost an enormous amount of manpower. Each star represents 100.
Yeah.
I look at it, just almost no end of stars. I was really very sorrowed by all that.
Mm. Were there some moments on that trip where you were surprised by what someone had to say to you?
It was amazing. Every place we went, during the trip and after the trip as we came back, so many, many people came up and said, thank you for your service. It was amazing. Young boys and girls, old men and women, it was a very nice feeling to have so many people come up and sincerely say, thank you for your service. Almost everybody did, hundreds of times or thousands of times.
How about the trip back?
I got to sit in the cockpit.
How'd you this pull that off?
This is a pilot, uh-huh. And there I am in the co-pilot seat. I guess I was the only pilot on the group going to Washington, D.C. I got to sit in the co-pilot seat, but they wouldn't let me land it.
Aw, man. If they had had to land on a carrier, I'm sure they would have let you do it.
If they had to land on a carrier, they better rely on them. Let me move over to this seat.
That's a big plane to land on a carrier, though.
It is, but it was great. We had bagpipes and music, everything honoring the World War II veterans, of which I was just one of them. Some of those veterans had a lot more service than I did. One guy was in on the invasion at Normandy. I respect those guys.
How did that all make you feel, that people would do this for you?
First of all, it gives me gratitude and a feeling of admiration for the United States and for the guy that did this. I respect that. Some guys did a lot more than I did of dangerous things. I respect and admire everybody that did that, and I respect and admire our flag. I still do. I guess I'm old-fashioned.
Is there something that you think people today can learn from what enabled America to win World War II?
I think maybe not myself, but I think the guys that served with me. I think we were the greatest generation, and I think that that's eroding somewhat. I think the new generation coming up could certainly learn from the guys that served with me. I hope they do.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us some of your stories. Do you want to clue the rest of us in on what your secret is? I mean, you're 98. What's the secret to staying in this good a shape at 98?
A good marriage.
Yeah?
That makes a huge difference. I had a great marriage, but we made each other happy. Really, Paul, I think that's the best thing I ever did, and that's an important thing about my longevity, I think. I always thought I would go before my wife, but I don't have control of that. She's been gone for 12 years now, but that's the only secret I can think of.
That's a good one.
The love that each member of my family has for each other, and they all honor their parents. Whatever you can leave on the table, that's about as big as anything you can leave.
Well, and since we have the youngest of your six children sitting right here, I think we ought to hear from her. Debbie, I can tell from all these photos, the documents, the medals, the mementos you've inventoried, you take a lot of pride in your father's service to our country.
I'm very proud of my father, proud of his military career, proud of his 60-year marriage and our great childhood. And I've been accused of being the most similar to Dad, but what I take away is, and I try to teach my children also, patriotism. I have my dad's great work ethic, which I'm very proud of and passed on to my children. Responsibility, organization, punctuality, maybe that's the military. But I'm very thankful for those character traits, and it's because of my father and because of his military career. So I'm very thankful for that, and will pass it on through the generations. I'm extremely proud of my father. I'm very patriotic. Every veteran I see, I thank them for their service, and it's just quite a legacy.
What was the honor flight experience like for you? Did you see something different in your dad or learn even more about him by sharing that experience with him?
The honor flight was a trip of a lifetime, and the leaders and the other veterans who went with are lifetime friends. I don't know that I learned anything more about my dad, but I learned more about our country and the branches of the military, just seeing every memorial. If I were to go back to Washington, D.C., there is no way I could duplicate that trip. Saw everything, and it was just so honoring and made me happy to see the respect that strangers showed my dad and these other veterans. There are 26 World War II veterans on this trip, and strangers and children would come and thank them for their service, children who had been trained well by their parents. And then the homecoming with the parade and the bagpipes and the hoopla and the USO and American Legion, and it's just the way it should be. And as Dell mentioned, the police escort, it was just, I'll never forget it. I wish all the veterans could go on it because it was absolutely fabulous, and they're treated like royalty as they should be.
You've heard a lot of his stories. Is there one story that gets your attention that you say, boy, how did he do that? Or maybe even say, hey, it's a good thing that worked out the way it did, or I might not even be here.
Well, I never tire of hearing the stories. And I learn something new every single time, and I keep adding notes. I learn more and add more notes, etc., and I'm just so proud. I think the main story that sticks with me is when his flight suit, his jumpsuit, was filled with the gas. I can't even imagine. But his dad says, you don't have time to be scared. You just do it, and you just react, and you maybe think about it afterwards. But I can't even imagine how many other close calls he had.
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully, he came through with flying colors and healthy and alive.
Anything else you want to say about him?
I love you, Father Byler. I'm trying to make you famous.
Well, there's a photo of father and daughter together for you online at hometownheroesradio.com and, of course, on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. But it's about time for the tail hook to catch the cable on this edition of Hometown Heroes. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.